Good evening. At this time, we begin the TechNet. Mel and Dick try to answer people's questions with the help of our friends, our fellow ham radio enthusiasts. The main purpose of the TechNet is to try to make this hobby a little bit more enjoyable. There's 25, 26, 27 different kinds of ham radio. The one you're listening to right now, FM 2-meter repeater type ham radio, is just one of the 26 kinds. And we discuss quite a few of the other kinds from time to time. Also, guys would like to know how to make their antennas work better, how to make their transmitters work better, which is the best receiver to buy, and so on. Lots of choices. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and follow that with a yes or a no, meaning you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name, and that yes or no. K2RIW listening.
N2EO, Rich, and yes.
Oh, we got Rich and a very noisy other station, so know that the other person besides Rich who signed in, your signal was very, very noisy, so maybe you can make some change so that we'll hear who you were. Any other people are checking, please give me your call letters and name at this time.
WS2N Paul, for the space report. Good evening, Dick.
So far we got Rich and Paul, and I'm sure Mel is there. Anyone else?
KB2YZK, Bob. No.
Good evening, this is K2KTY.
KC2SKI, my name is Myers.
Good evening,
no question.
Okay, we've got Mel. We've got Bob with a no, Morris with a no, and I think a very, very noisy WC2C, but I'm not sure. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WC7ABS, Rob, no.
W2BIE, Lou, no.
Okay, we've got Morris and Bob and Lou all with a no, and EWK, I think, with a no. Eugene. Anyone else?
N2GOT, no.
Okay, GOT with a no. So far, we've only got a single yes. Rich, must be somebody out there with some questions. Give me a call letters and names at the time.
N2FPJ, Bob, and yes.
Put me down for a yes, then, Dick, WS2N.
Oh, we're certainly going to have a space report, for Paul and Bob into MPJ with a yes. We got another live one. Hey, Mel, we got two live ones. Okay, anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Now, you can put me down for a question, Dick, WS1.
Oh, wow. Both a space report and a question. Very good. Anyone else? Last call.
W2PNJ, no questions as of yet.
Okay, PNJ, Bob, with a no so far. And QIW, quite noisy, also with a no so far. Okay, let's find out what's going on in Whitestone. Rich, N2EO, bring us up to date. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, good evening, N2EO. Dick, while I'm talking, maybe you could go to the Cubex website, cubex.com. That's the manufacturer of the quantum line. I wonder what you think. See, if you go on their website, you'll see all their quads are shown mounted on a self-supporting crank-up, crank-over tower. If you know, I'm putting up a quad-pod tower on the peak of the roof. And originally I was going to go with a two-element. I know my mother was still alive. She'd say I'm being greedy. But I'm thinking of going with a three-element, Dick. And I wonder what you think the 7.5 square feet for three elements. You look at the specs on the website. I don't know how accurate they are, but he claims 6 to 9 dBi for charging on a two element. And I think it's 10 to 12 dBi for three elements. So wonder what you think of that. The contractor, I spoke to him. He is going to mount the tower the way you and Andy CDL suggested. He's going to put 2x8s on top of the roof, pressure-treated lumber, go through with either 5/16 or 3/8 inch threaded rod, pick up on 2x8s in the attic, running the length of the attic, so it shares all the joists in the attic to support that Glen Martin quad pod tower. Also, Nick, you might take a look at these. He's got dual band VHF, UHF quads. He's got one called the Scorpion 88, 8 elements 2 meters, 8 elements 440. I was thinking of putting that up as well in the center. He claims, I believe, 14 dB isotropic on both 2 and 440. I wonder what you think of that. K2RIW, Tech Net Limelock, and 2EO.
Cubex is spelled C-U-B-E-X or Q-U-B-E-X, Rich, go ahead.
Charlie, C-U-B-E-X.com.
Okay, I tried spelling it with a Q, and alrighty, I did find Cubex, and tell me once again which antenna.
Yeah, if you look under HF antennas, the Mark series, MK, the Mark 2, which is the two element, or the Mark 3, which is the three element.
Very good. I'm on the Mark 2 and the Mark 3. I see them both right now. And once again, please repeat your question with reference. I think you were comparing wind load versus dBi of gain. Reasonably healthy prices there, by the way. $585 for the 2 and $935 for the 3, Mark 3. I was having trouble finding the website, so tell me again, what's the two things you want us to compare, Rich? Go ahead.
Well, first of all, if you go down to the bottom, it's specifications. He's got the specs. You can click on specs. He rates the two element about 5.5 square feet of wind load. The three element is 7.5 square feet. I wonder if that extra 2 square feet is unwise on that Glen Martin tower. The tower's good for like 15 square feet, but, you know, on a wood roof, I don't know. I told you, he's putting it in the same way you suggested and Andy suggested with the 2x8. There's the gain figures. I wonder if you really think he's claiming that the three, by adding the director, you pick up 3 dB.
Yeah, I'm seeing gain of 7 to 9 dBi on the Mark 2.3 PT3. And I'm seeing a gain of 10 to 12 on the Mark 3. My goodness, about it, that is dBi, but just like you say, 3 dB more on both of those numbers. And by the way, that's an awful long gain there, awful long range. 7 to 9, 3 dB of range and gain, I guess it's on the various bands. I should know, but tell me, what bands does this antenna, both the 2-element and 3-element, what bands does it work on, Rich? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm using the PT5, which is 10, 12, 15, 17, and 20 meters. And I'm going to feed it the way he recommends with a quarter-wave matching section of 75 ohm line on 10, 12, and 15 meters. And your remote switch mounted on the boom to switch in whichever element you want to use.
Hmm. Okay. I'm not much of an HF man, as you guys know. I'm a VHF, UHF, SHF person. I'm hoping that the president of Kings County Radio Club and the people who back him up, his cabinet of people, his staff of experts, the library staff that he has manning the website, answering all those questions. Mel, I hope you have a lot more experience with these particular antennas and can add your words of wisdom here. I don't have anywhere near as many. Mel, help. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, good evening. Yeah, this is K2KEY. The limited amount of work that I've done with Quad, that was in the past, I can say it was a little bit more difficult years ago because you had to made more or less put them together. There was no kits involved, so building the main fighters were a bit of a problem, and the bad move was the support. You didn't have the fiberglass rods available. As far as reliability at that time, they weren't that reliable because the winter, every year you had it, well, you never got through a winter, let's put it this way, without service or something. That would be common complaint with quads, no matter what you did. For some reason, they things came apart. So hopefully, you know, that they have made strides and now have, you know, licked the mechanical problems of the quad. Why, I don't know why you particularly picked the quad, Rich. Maybe you can elaborate maybe a little bit more. Why quad over a Yagi? Where I think the Yagi most likely would be a little bit more simpler to install. And also, you know, the good, well-made Yagi, such as I have here, I use mostly Yagi for a number of years and been very satisfied with them. Stood a lot of bad conditions. So I'm wondering what has turned you more or less towards the quad over the Yagi. I mean, there must be a specific reason for it, I would assume, Rich, over.
Case you two, RSF. RSF recognized. Rich, go ahead.
Okay, Dick, and okay, Mel. The reason I'm going with a quad, Mel, it's a matter of rope. The property is very long and very narrow. I'm in a semi-attached house, and going the width, I've got only 25 and a half feet from one end of the property to the other. That ain't much. So the tower is going to be put not in the center of the roof, but in the center of the property, which only gives me about a little over a 12-foot turning radius. And anything I put up in the way of a tri-band beam, even a two-element Yagi, has a much greater turning radius than that, because the shortest thing you're going to get is 28-foot element from 20 meters. So I'd be over the neighbor's property. I was able to do that years ago, but, you know, I grew up with their kids. You know, these are all different neighbors now, and I don't want to tempt fate. So the neighbors all changed over. The quad has an 8-foot boom, 17 by 17 foot on the elements. And it's the only thing I can put up that's not a compromised antenna that will really perform. And I got to tell you, I had a quad years ago, Mel, and it really kicked butt on the band. It was a good antenna.
Okay, that's one heck of a testimonial. Let's find out what other people have got to say. K2RSF, I think, was your call letters. Start off with your name, sir, and then your question or comment. K2RAW, my name is Dick. I'm not sure I heard somebody check in name RSF. Anyone hear it call letters differently?
That was it, Dick. Maybe he didn't realize it was that.
I want to make one more comment, Dick. Dick.
Yeah, Mel, one quick question I've got for you, and that is, I am guessing that the X-like support structure that we've all seen in the used for supporting the wires for a cubicle quad. Really has the wire in a full wavelength loop, and it becomes a half-wave dipole above and a half-wave dipole below on each individual loop. But each one of those wires on the four sides is really a the string on a guitar, so to speak. I can see how the wire would wave back and forth, maximum deflection in between the support points, and maximum bending moment at the support points. I am guessing, therefore, that cubicle quads typically fail from wire fatigue at the four corners of the loop. Correct me if I'm wrong in my guess, and do you think someone has come up with some crafty way of stopping the metal fatigue in that area? And go ahead with your further comments on quads. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, in the case where I've had it, I could service it, you know, easily enough. But in a case where it is going to be a problem, Rich, I don't know if you have access, you know, from the house to the roof, if there's a way of getting out there, or you have to put a ladder up. That's the only reason I question the quad. I understand what they have done, you know, about some of the mechanical problems. I saw one of the more modern fighters, and I understand they have also come up with this idea of using the end pieces to reduce the amount of friction of against wires. Yeah, that was where they were breaking. You're right, Dick, the corners used to break fairly often, and I guess just the flexing of it. So, in the case like yours, Rich, yeah, I can understand with the turning radius situation, but I was wondering, what is the reliability now? I haven't really stepped into quads in many years. Got turned off, I could say, by the situation. I don't know if I would say that a quad is better than a Yagi. I would say a three-element quad and a three-element Yagi. I would go say, Dick, from what I've heard, comparisons, a number of articles, people have actually put them up and, you know, on the systems that they could have, you know, simultaneously one power with a quad, one power with a Yagi, and I have never heard of anyone consistently saying that, you know, the quad or the Yagi is a better performer. So, I understand that Rich problems there, but I wouldn't, you know, say that the quad is going to be a better performer than the Yagi, Dick, over.
Well, there was a beautiful article in Ham Radio Magazine 20 or so years ago. I can't remember the Wayne Overbeck is the man's name. K6YNB, I think, was his call letters at the time. And he did two things of significance, at least two. Number one, he came up with the quad-fed Yagi, the quad antenna, which enjoyed quite a bit of popularity for a while. A popular antenna in California because it uses a wooden boom, and this is a 432 antenna, and I suspect people have also made 2-meter versions of it. But his philosophy was that if he launches the signal with a cubicle quad reflector and driven element, and the rest are ordinary parasitic Yagi elements, Wayne Overbeck was convinced that you come out ahead. Another thing that Wayne did, because he was hearing the controversy year after year of the quad people saying quads are better than Yagis and vice versa, he went and got himself I believe it was an 80-foot crank-up tower mounted on a trailer. And he literally went a fraction of a mile away from the big guns in California. He would park the trailer a fraction of a mile away and measure their signal strength. And he did it with a bunch of guys with Yagis and a bunch of guys with cubicle quads. And he measured real signal strength a fraction of a mile away. And the conclusion he came to is there was an extremely slight edge on the cubicle quad, slightly ahead of the Yagi. And the explanation was that each individual loop of a cubicle quad is a full wavelength, which you could say is a two closely stacked, vertical stacked pair of Yagis. One halfway dipole above the other is what the cubicle quad element really is. And whether you set it up as a square quad where the two of the wires are parallel to the ground or set it up in the diamond configuration, it doesn't matter. If you feed it to be purely horizontally polarized, in either case, you've got two antennas vertically stacked above the other, but much too close for spacing. The people who are doing computer modeling came to the conclusion that for a small number of elements, two, three, and four elements, the cubical quad should have a slight advantage if you use the right materials and you have good impedance matching and it's a good antenna design. But when it comes to a very large number of elements where the effective capture area becomes extremely large, the fact that the spacing is so close no longer gives you that advantage. I do remember some of the guys on 432 building 14 element cubical quad antennas for 432. And the experiments they ran seemed to say there was no great advantage in gain. Now, whether or not there's again an advantage when you set it up in the diamond configuration, so that the water gathers at the bottom of the diamond, where it's innocuous, at the center of the element, so to speak, the driven point.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Good thing I'm listening. And not at the tips of the elements, where in the case of a 432 or a 1296 Yagi in particular, on a morning where you've got very heavy dew with great big droplets of water on the tips of the antenna, on 432 quite a bit and on 1296 a whole lot, you do experience detuning. And a loop antenna and a properly set up diamond-like quad antenna will not suffer that characteristic. That doesn't affect Rich because he's down at the frequency where water isn't there. Wonder if anyone else, for those who tuned in late, what's going on is Rich in 2EO is considering buying either the two-element or the three-element Mark II or Mark III antenna made by the Cubex company. He's considering installing a cubical quad two-element or three-element Yagi. He has chosen it because it has a smaller turning radius, a little bit smaller in optical impact, so to speak. He's hoping his neighbors won't give him any flack with the thing. My first impression is the antenna has a significant number of dollars of cost. Thank goodness Rich is well-heeled, and maybe that's not a factor. So anyone with any pros or cons of a Yagi versus a cubicle quad for the HF bands that Rich is interested in, if you've got some opinions or past experience, even secondhand knowledge, in other words, a buddy of yours, a friend of a cousin in California, and put one of these up and liked it or didn't like it, if you've got any of those opinions, please chime in right now and let us know about it. K2RAWNOTechNet, we're listening.
Best to answer.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Okay, secondhand information anyway. Cubex Quad, anyway, you asked about HF. One guy I know, he's got one for 2 meters and loves it. I think it's a 13 element. But he's on most Thursday nights on a simplex now that we get on and shoot our beams into Connecticut. And he's had it for many years, and he loves the thing. And you know, he's got some kind of a tower through the roof and all. Sounds something similar to what Rich is trying to do. But it's 2 meters, but it's that same company, Cubex. And I remember going to the website and looking at it. And all I can say is he was happy the way it went together and all. So if it's anything similar to the HF, I'm guessing he'd probably go with that too. Back to you there, XWS1.
Very fine, Paul. Thank you for the additional information. I've got some other opinions I just thought of now, and that is with reference to wind load there, Rich. You've chosen a rooftop mounted tower with 2x8, great big long carriage bolts going through the roof, and something like 2x4s or 2x8s on the inside of the rafters. So the rafter of the roof will be sandwiched between the tip and the base of this carriage bolt. So you're really going to be grabbing a number of rafters of the roof in a very solid manner. As such, with properly chosen tower and tower mounting procedure, it is my opinion, Rich, that wind load is not the determining factor. It's not the determinant. Even if it was, there's a way around that. And that is, If you fell in love with the three-element Yagi and its high gain performance compared to the two, and if wind load is the only thing stopping you, a person with the right kind of a computer program or the right kind of mechanical engineering background, knowing the exact model number of the tower you're putting up, and knowing the characteristics of your particular roof, maybe it's got 18-inch on center spacing of the rafters, maybe the rafters are 2x8, and the roof itself has got the right TECO plates, so it's held down and it's not going to blow away in a windstorm. Once you've got all of that basic material to give the roof integrity, and to give the tower mounted to the roof integrity, wind load should no longer be a factor. And even if it was, the next step, if you really fell in love with the three-element Yagi, and wanted to tolerate the higher wind load, the next step would be to put two, three, or four guy wires from some appropriate location on the rooftop tower over to the four corners of the roof of the house. So, by way of guy wires and by way of proper mechanical engineering, I know you can make wind load not a factor. And then it's going to be, is the performance really there? Is the longevity there? Is it going to require periodic maintenance that's maybe hard to get to? And are the dollars the factor? So I think we can remove wind load. You're down to dollars, performance, and longevity as I see it. And Mel, maybe just some extra words. I'm going to pass it back to Mel one more time. Okay, anything else you want to add to help Rich with this fairly difficult decision? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Dick, right here now, in that mode. No, basically, you brought up the same thinking I was going along with, the ideas of maintenance. What reliability? I mentioned quagging. I use the quagging. At field day, I built a quaggy, but I put 70 centimeters. It works quite well, that quaggy. So I would say that's a decent antenna for 70 centimeters. But getting down to 20 meters would be, in other words, this cubic is basically a 20 meter beam, I would assume. In other words, the wire is that actually a full wave? The elements, a full wave on 20, is that the way it's laid out, Rich? Over.
I'm going to break in there. As I look at the picture, Mel, I see it as a number of cubicle quads mounted inside of each other. So I think it's covering 10, 15, and 20 at least. Did I guess correctly on that one? Over to you, Rich.
Well, that's correct, Dick, except you can hear for a few dollars more, you can add 12 and 17 to it. And if you look at the wind loading, it's a fraction more. The wire is not the determining factor in wind loading. Roger?
Okay. So I think it's coming down to performance, dollars, and longevity. And I'd like to believe that Cubex has solved this classic problem of cubicle quad antennas, metal fatigue in the four corners. And if they've got either a wire that doesn't fatigue, or they've got some kind of a fancy mounting mechanism, I'm going to call it a strain relief mechanism. I mean, the wires that come out of our microphones and go into the plug, the connector that goes into the front panel of our receivers, they require strain relief, and as such, transceivers. And as such, if the manufacturer's done a good job, for a reasonable number of years, you can pull on that wire, and it keeps working. By the same token, a guy with enough mechanical engineering smarts can do something to do strain relief on the four corners where the wires meet the support on the cubicle quad and stop that fatigue failure from occurring. Let's hope that Cubex has done that. And if they hadn't, of course, they would be developing a bad reputation by now, and we hams are very good at talking to each other about what we like and what we don't like, particularly the guys on HF. They share every little bit of information we got. I'm beginning to think, Rich, the next step in making your selection would be to get on to any band you're capable of getting on to, HF, and see if you can find people with direct testimonial that I bought the model number so-and-so, and I love it, or I'm not so happy with it. That's the next step you can go to. From my point of view, this is a fair number of dollars. The ones you're talking about, with all the bells and whistles, I think, let's see now, that's the three-element job. The Mark III, and that's before you add the other bands in there, that's $935. I think that's a fair number of dollars. That's the price of what I think the transceiver should cost. And so, not being an HF person, maybe I've got a little bit of sticker shock on HF antennas. Anyone with any further comments, give us your call letters right now. KQRIW on the TechNet.
CDO.
Go right ahead, Andy. I hope you've got some knowledge on this subject. I'm a little light, as you can tell. You got it, Andy.
Okay, no, actually, I'm in the middle of something. I wasn't paying attention except the fact that I noticed that there was a beep at the end. It was not in net mode. So it's back in the net mode for you guys, just to let you know, Dick. Back to you.
Well done, Andy. And we'll make sure your salary is doubled for doing that. Okay. Rich, we're going to pass it back to you. Looks like you haven't got as much information out of us as you'd like, but one person knows what he doesn't know. I know I don't know. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, very good. Well, I can tell you the way I questioned him, Roger, his name is the owner of Quebec, on how they attach the wires. What they do now is they feed the wires through a hole in the spreader, the way you would feed an spread through the eye of a needle, and then to keep it from going out of square and migrating, they take a piece of wire, wrap it once around the spreader, and then wrap it around the wire on both ends, you know, both sides where it goes to the spreader. And he said, you don't solder it, because if you solder it, it gets stiff, and you'll make a point that can break. So as far as the money, Dick, I'm not worried about that because I gave up cigarettes for the second month now. And you should know, cigarettes here in the city in Queens, $70 a carton. I was going through 4 to 5 cartons a month. So to spend on the quad instead of cigarettes is money well spent. So that doesn't faze me one bit. A couple of months worth of cigarettes that I no longer smoke. But do you believe, and then we'll go on to the next person, do you believe that adding the director, in other words, not just the human element and the reflector, but going to add a director, you'll pick up 3DD? That's an awful lot. And if you look at the DA, he has a dual band VHF, UHF, you go with dual band antennas, called for the Scorpion 88. I believe it's 8 elements on 2, 8 elements on 440. He claims 14 dB isotropic both bands. Back to you, Dick, in 2 EM.
Okay, your first question is, can a director give you 3 dB of gain increase on a 2-element Yagi? And the answer is it can come pretty close. I would have said 2.5, but my own personal experience on 3-element Yagis that I've done a lot of fiddling with at 900 megacycles. Yes, a properly spaced, properly tuned third element, that director, buys a hell of a lot of performance. A healthy 2.5 dB, and maybe closer to 3, the more I think about it. So, that is possible. I'm not saying that this guy does it, but he's not beyond physics to do that. The other antenna, sorry to say, I don't have experience with it, but I think you're really asking me, can you get, I believe the number was 14 dB of gain out of, was it 10 elements you were asking, Rich? Go ahead.
Yeah, I got to go back to the website. 8 elements or 10 elements, I forget, 14 dBi. If you need a computer, they take a look at, my computer is away from the mic. VHF, UHF, dual band antennas. List the particular antenna, the 14 dB isotropic on both 2 meters and 70 centimeters.
Okay, I see VHF, UHF quads. I'm looking for VHF, UHF dual banders. Yep, found it. VHF, UHF, dual bander. And I'm waiting for my computer to respond. And I see the first one called Yellow Jacket 46. 9 and 10 dBi of gain. Is the first one, Scorpion 88. 14 dBi, that's the one I think you're talking about. Front to back 25. Front to back is hard to make a judgment on because carefully tuned at one particular angle, anybody can make a high front to back ratio. That doesn't necessarily mean you've got high gain. 14 dBi, and let's see how many elements has he got there. I'm going to count them from the picture. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I see 8 elements of a quad, and he's claiming 14 dBi. 12 dB over ISO, 12 dB over dipole. I know it takes 19 elements to bake 15 dB over dipole. Well, let's be a little bit realistic here, Rich. He's claiming 14. If he made 13 and not 14, would you and I really know the difference? 1/6 of an S unit, I think not. If it's a reasonably well-tuned antenna and is getting approximately that amount of gain, and by way of the beamwidth, if he gives us the pattern in the beamwidth, we can double-check. The reason I say that is because there's an amazing number of antennas, particularly television aerials, where the manufacturer makes wild claims for gain, and then he gives you the pattern, and when you measure the 3 dB beamwidth of the pattern, you plug it into the formula, you realize you can't possibly be getting that gain. Pattern versus gain is a necessary but not sufficient. In other words, just to give you an example, a 15.5 dB gain at 432 is going to have something like 23 degrees of beamwidth. That doesn't mean every 23-degree beamwidth antenna has got 15 dB of gain. But it does mean every antenna with 15 dB of gain over dipole must have 23 or less degrees of beamwidth. Otherwise, you just can't get there. So necessary but not sufficient. So quite a few of these antennas, they make crazy gain claims that when you look at the pattern and the beamwidth is not there and he doesn't have the raw ingredients, he can't possibly be doing it. So he made a mistake somewhere in his measurement procedure. That's about as much help as I can give you right now, Rich. I'm going to go on. If we get some time left over, we'll come back to you. Now, the next person on our list, who's both going to give us a space report eventually when we give him that chance, and he's got a real question. That's Paul, WS2N. What are those guys in Ronkonkoma doing tonight, Paul? Did you get any snow out there? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yeah, with the wind, it looked like a mini blizzard there for about a half hour. But, yeah, we got snow that stuck to the ground. But it's kind of like blown away. Nothing in the street, nothing in the driveway. Still a little bit on the grass there. I think I thought I'd ask a question about moisture getting into the wires, into the cables. I was wondering what happens when the moisture gets absorbed into, let's say, RGAU cable, for instance. That's what I use for any of the coax cables that we use. You know, what actually happens to the wires? Why does it really fail when the moisture gets in? The resistance goes so low on the shielded part of the cable, and that changes the SWR. Moisture gets so bad where it's actually like shorting out between the shield and the center conductor. You know, how different is it, for instance, than, let's say, your car when you have spark plug wires and they tend to absorb moisture all the time. You have dulled wires and they just like to absorb moisture like a sponge, even on a damp day. Does your resistance go down? Is that the reason they fail? Maybe you can give a little talk on the difference. What happens? Let's say the difference between car wires that absorb moisture. Why does that fail? Your car was car won't start, and yet the same thing basically happens to RGAU cable or any coax cable when they get wet. But I have a feeling they fail for different reasons. Back over to you, WS2N.
Yeah, darn good question, Paul, and there's a lot to it. At VHF, UHF frequencies, water is an extremely lofty material. It's good dummy load material. The best example of that is Mr. Southworth, in around 1938, when he's working at Bell Laboratories, was essentially inventing waveguide, or at least doing some very serious waveguide experiments. And he's published a couple of books on the subject. And what he did to create a dummy load for his waveguide, and some of the earliest waveguide was downspout tubing from the gutters from your house. And you choose the right diameter of the downspout tubing, and at the right frequency, it makes a darn good piece of waveguide. But he needed a dummy load at the end of it. And so he would take the downspout tubing, put it into a trough of water at an extremely shallow angle. So the water inside became a wedge of water. And that became an extremely good dummy load. The water was slowly introduced to the waveguide, or the wave going down the guide would slowly see this wedge of water gets wider and wider as it goes further down, and the water absorbed the energy and essentially nothing reflected. And so for the experiments where he needed a good dummy load and no reflection, that served the purpose very nicely. Since then, we've invented all kinds of absorbing materials you can put at the end of a waveguide. But, by the way, you always do it in a pyramid or a triangular or a wedge-shaped manner, no matter what materials you use. And the anechoic material you put into a chamber also is built usually in pyramid shape. The sharp point slowly absorbs the RF energy as it goes down the sides of the mountain, if you know what I mean. Okay. When water gets into a connector, water almost always contains salt of some kind. Salt built up from the water, absorbing mineral matter from the connector itself, your fingerprint, whatever. Pure, absolutely distilled water is a reasonably good insulator. But the slightest amount of salty material or anything dissolved in that water makes it conductive very fast. So water in a connector is the primary method by which you get launched right away. When I had my array of 16 Yagis and 432 up, which means I had, well, let me think now, I had about 35 or 38 connectors altogether. When you think of the connectors on each end of the cable going to the Yagis, on the other end going to the power divider, and then the power dividers going into another power divider, I had connectors all over the place. And I really worried that any one of those connectors could create an awful lot of grief in that system. I made sure that each individual driven element was insulated from the boom. Because the Yagis were insulated from the boom, I, with a little bit more smarts, I could do the same thing with the driven element, and therefore I could sit in the shack with my ohm meter, measure between the center conductor and the shield of the feed line, and know if there was water in any connector. On a really good day, when everything was nice and dry, the whole system would be well above 10 megaohms from center conductor to shield. As a drop of water got into one connector of those 38 or so connectors, I would see the resistance come down real fast. It would jump down below a megaohm. When it started getting down to about 300 kiloohms or so, I could see significant increase in the loss. In other words, the normal signals I would talk to would be quite a bit weaker. So water in the connector is certainly a good way you can get an awful lot of loss. My favorite kind of jumper cable that goes around the rotator is RG9, which is really equivalent to RG214. Double shielded, polyethylene, RG8-like cable. I like the double shield because it's nice and sturdy, can take a lot of bending, a lot of flexing, it's got a lot of strength to it. But I like solid polyethylene cable, even though it's a little bit higher in loss.
TOS, lockup detect.
I'm only using a couple of feet of it for that jumper that goes around the rotator, so the fact that it's got more loss per foot almost doesn't matter because I'm not using very many feet of it. But solid polyethylene is almost impervious to water. Water does not get into solid polyethylene, the semiconductor, the dielectric material between semiconductor and shield. A little bit of water getting into the braid of solid polyethylene cable until it gets to the point where the water is so salty, it's been there for so long, you start corroding away the cable, and now you start getting breaks until you get to that point.
Node number 4478, link
clear.
Until you get to that point, you don't get a heck of a lot of extra loss. That's the good news. However, almost all the guys you and I can talk to who want to have low-loss cable buy whatever cable they can find that has a very low loss number, and by definition, almost all of them have foamed dielectric material. Once your dielectric material is made out of not solid polyethylene, but anything other than Teflon that is foamed, it has a mechanism by which it can absorb water.
Any error has occurred. COS lockup detect.
Any water being absorbed into the foamed coax has an entirely different loss mechanism. You may or may not be able to detect it with an ohmmeter. You can only really detect its presence by measuring the insertion loss of the cable. And you can measure the insertion loss of the cable by two techniques. You put a watt of power or 100 watts of power in one end, and with your bird watt meter or any other kind of instrumentation, you measure how many watts comes out of the other end. That's the direct approach. A slightly indirect approach.
An error has occurred. COS lockup detect.
A slightly indirect approach is to open circuit the far end of the cable and measure standing wave ratio. With the cable being open circuited at the far end, if the cable was lossless, you would measure infinite standing wave ratio. If the cable has, oh, let me think, 5 dB of loss, you would have 5 dB of loss to the signal going out. It hits the open circuit, all of the energy reflects, another 5 dB of loss coming back, total of 10 dB of loss. Well, 10 dB of reflection coefficient is roughly a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So by measuring standing wave ratio with an open circuited length of cable of known length, if you know the number of feet long and you measure the standing wave ratio with a little bit of not too complicated mathematics, you can figure out what is the real insertion loss of the cable. I call it a slightly indirect method. Maybe it's a direct method, but you're measuring it two ways when you open circuit the cable. Now, what is the mechanism by which the cable gives you loss? Water does not resonate at 24 or 50 megacycles. There's an amazing number of people who think that a microwave oven at 24 or 50 megacycles was chosen at that frequency because it has some kind of resonance with the water. Absolutely not. The first resonance of water vapor occurs at the 24 gigahertz. So at 2.4 gigahertz, the water definitely gives you loss, but it's not due to resonance. It's due to, I'm going to call it dielectric loading. The water molecule is a dipole-like molecule. In other words, it's a little bit more positive at one end and a little bit more negative at the other end. When you put RF energy at VHF and UHF frequencies into a substance containing water or water vapor, each individual molecule of the water tries to flip back and forth and follow the polarity of the RF on each individual half cycle. While the water is mechanically, the water molecule is being mechanically moved, and it doesn't keep up. It falls behind. It lags. And that lag creates both a capacitive effect where the water has a dielectric constant of 81, and second of all, it creates an area inside the BH curve, as they say, where the voltage left and right and the current up and down doesn't follow the exact same path up and down. It creates an elliptical shape, and the area inside the lips represents loss. So water is an extremely lossy material. When you put your food in the microwave oven, the majority of the heating is the water in the food. You put a cup of water and extremely dry, hard, old-fashioned bread in the oven, and the bread will run cold and the cup of water will get hot. It's only the water, most of the time, doing the heating. There's some other substances in your food, but most of our food contains water, and it's the water that's doing the heating. So what happens when you've got water vapor in the foam of your coax, or if you're using the old-fashioned RG9913 cable, which had an air channel down the center and water could get into it, you have an extreme mechanism by which the water can give you loss. So that's the major loss you get with water in the foam. It doesn't happen with polyethylene and solid cables, and cables that are extremely well shielded, sealed, like hardline cable. Water can also collect in the connector. When it's in the connector, it's both got the dielectric loss mechanism I've been talking about, as well as a conductive loss mechanism that you can measure with your ohmmeter. One or two drops of water in the middle of a tight end connector, at 432, I have personally measured 10 decibels of extra loss. Some of it's due to Vizwar, some of it due to power absorption. It doesn't matter. You really got to work very hard to keep water out of your connectors. Now, when it comes to water in ignition wiring, slightly different mechanism occurs. Your spark plug would like to have wiring that's capable of delivering 30 kilovolts or more. The spark plug is going to arc over way before that. However, depending on the richness of the mixture in the cylinder, depending on how much power you're asking for out of the automobile, the breakdown voltage across that spark plug changes. And you'll probably notice at times when you have a car that's got very strong ignition static in the radio, you'll notice that the ignition static gets louder when you press down in the accelerator. It's not only because the engine is running faster, but because it's running at a richer mixture of fuel, which gives it a higher dielectric strength of the fuel mixture. Therefore, a higher voltage occurs in the spark plug before the spark plug finally breaks down, and therefore the ignition noise it makes is louder. So your wiring to your spark plug would like to have the capability of going to 30 kilovolts and beyond. When you have voltages that high on that wiring, not only does the wire have to be nice and dry, made out of the right kind of plastic, and good insulating material that can tolerate high voltage, also the rubber boot around the spark plug itself must be made out of non-conducting material. If you happen to have, if there's something wrong with your engine that's pouring oil under that spark plug and that boot of the spark plug, it can make it conductive and short out that particular plug. So to make a transmission system of an automobile work correctly, the wiring has to not be arcing over. The boot has to be not conducting where the wire touches the spark plug, and also the distributor cap, you want to make sure there's nothing wrong there. I remember once bringing my automobile to a down south company where you put some quarters in the machine, and they give you this wand that squirts the soapy water on the automobile, and I wanted to wash down my engine, and I did. I wanted my engine to look nice and clean on my Corvair automobile. I wasn't smart enough to realize I was squirting soapy water into all the nooks and crannies of that car, and it got into the distributor cap. And that engine didn't run for the next X number of hours. Boy, did I have trouble. So you don't want any water or conducting substances inside of that distributor cap, otherwise it creates a whole lot of phony short circuits where the spark coil was trying to fire every single plug simultaneously, and of course that engine was extremely unhappy. So one last point about high voltage wiring, and that is my Windhurst machine. It's one of these little static generators. It requires very little dust on the machine and very dry humidity, because although it's producing 100 kilovolts of voltage, it only has a few microamperes of capability. Therefore, it cannot tolerate anything that's more conductive than something like 100 megohms or 1,000 megohms. So the machine can be shorted out very easily by putting it into a high humidity room. So water is, in general, very conductive, particularly if it contains any salt. So in the connector, it can give you loss. Water has dielectric loss. That's how the microwave oven works. Water getting into the foam of your coax will make it very lossy in ways that might not show up with an ohmmeter, but it will show up on a power meter when you do the right kind of a test. These are some of the mechanisms by which you and I have to fight pretty hard to keep water out of our transmission line systems, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the deck
net. K2KY, we're coming.
Okay, stand by there, Paul. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, well, I sometimes have measured coax, with the TDR, and AEA called a PDA. Now you notice that the graphic display, and it shows you, at the end, the open, short, and the distance. But if you have a piece of coax that has water in it, you see these little bumps in the waves. It shows you little glitches in there. I've cut open a bad piece of coax cable that really displays a number of these glitches. And what I found is the water got in that between the outer jacket and the center insulating material, the braid, for some reason, really deteriorated extremely bad. The braid from a nice clean-looking copper color had turned this blackish color, and actually, if you rubbed your fingers on it, the braid actually deteriorated in between your fingers, Dick Golden.
KV1RF, why would a comment? KB1 RFI, I think it is. Very loud audio, so you have to back off a little bit. But before we go to you, Mel, the cable that crumbled in your fingers, what's your guess as to how long the water had been in there? I'm guessing it wasn't a month. I'm guessing it was 3 years. Back to you, Mel.
I don't know. Yes, it could have been a couple of years. It wasn't RDAQ. It was a 72-ohm coax that we used in surveillance systems. And the picture quality actually had the equivalent of conditions that you would have if you were using it for, you know, transmitting, receiving deterioration in the signal. But in this case, the picture quality was very poor, sort of smeary, washed out type of effect. And they went there to change the cameras and everything like that. When I got there with the instrument, because that was basically my job running around, where they couldn't solve the problem. You know, our regular service people couldn't solve the problem. I'd go there and take a look with instruments. And I saw on PDA, or the PDR, using AEA's instrument, that there were some glitches in the coax and a distance away. I could see that the coax that was inside the building, running the distance of the building until it exited the building and ran along the wall, that's where the trouble is. So it just cut out that section, and that cleaned up the problem. So I took that piece that was defective, and when I split it open, you could see that the water got in and deteriorated the shield to the point, like I say, where you could just fell apart between your fingers. It was out there a number of times. I think most of the problem, of course, is what ruined the jacket. It was banging up against the wall, the brick wall of the building. It got loose and not enough support. So banging up against the brick, building eventually caused the jacket, the insulation, outer covering, to fail, Dick, over.
Good information. Thank you, Mel. I think it was KB2RFU or something like that. Correct me on your call letters. Tell me your name, and then proceed with your comments, sir.
Kilo Bravo 1, India Fox Yankee, KB1IFY. The first name is Bill. And I went through a similar problem. It wasn't coax, though. It was a base station antenna. It's called an Austin Suburban. I actually had one. I had it up for 3 weeks, filled up with water, contacted the store I bought it from, and then they told me to contact the manufacturer. I sent it back to New Hampshire. They shipped me another one that did the same thing. And finally, what I ended up doing was bringing it back up to the store. I got full credit. I put the difference in and got a comment. So not only coax, sometimes these base station antennas can get water in them. So back to you, Dick, KB1IFY.
Pretty fine, Bill. Bill, what's your guess as to how the water was getting into the antenna? When you look at the radome for the antenna, did you see a definite place where water could easily get in?
Yeah, what happened was, on the bottom of the antenna, there's like a rubber boot. It looks like a stick, the antenna. Mind you, a mobile antenna, anyway, to make a long story short. Sort of like a whip. Got like a rubber boot, and they didn't put enough silicone on there, I guess. That's RTV, or whatever they would seal it up with. The water was getting into there. That's how it got into the first one. The second one, I brought it back up to Lentini's where I bought it, and the fellow up there looked at it. He had the loop, and he even saw all the pinholes in the second antenna. Now, you think the company would be smart enough? I sent one antenna back with that problem. They shipped me back another antenna. You think they'd be smart enough to fix the problem in the first place?
Yeah, quite possibly some low-level person in the organization thought it was a maverick, and without thinking, just shipped you another one, not realizing they're duplicating the problem. Okay, sounds like you created quite a bit of education there. So getting back to Paul's original question, as you can see, Paul, there's a number of mechanisms by which water in electronics can create a lot of grease. One of the hard things to believe is that the beautiful-looking outer polyethylene jacket, polyvinyl chloride jacket, on foam-filled, flexible, braided outer coax conductor, foam-filled cable will eventually, in my opinion, outdoors always absorb water, because the water vapor will propagate through the outer polyvinyl chloride jacket. Hard to believe. I mean, it looks like a perfect weather seal. Well, it's not. The only thing that's a perfect weather seal is either a glass or a metal seal. Hardline cable is capable of being weather sealed. Flexible cable that has braid for the outer conductor cannot be weather sealed. There are some better made flexible cables where there is a foil in the outer braid, either above or under the outer braid, doesn't matter, but as long as there is a well-sealed foil, it can keep out moisture. Metal can keep out moisture. Plastic and rubber cannot. That's a hard thing to believe. I mean, we wear rubber raincoats, and we wear rubber galoshes, and from our point of view, they keep out the water. They do a beautiful job of keeping out the water for a short period of time that we use them on a rainy day. But when your cable is sitting out there day in and day out, in the hot and cold cycles, ultraviolet, high and low temperature, high and low humidity and whatever, ingressing and outgressing air through the cable as temperatures and pressures and everything else change, water vapor will slowly migrate through that jacket. So therefore, braided cables with foam on the inside have a finite life to them. It's only about a year or two if you're a serious VHF operator. I bought what I thought was extremely high quality cable way back in 1978. It was called ITT-FM8. Very well looking, constructed, foam-filled cable. You carefully put type-in connectors on the end and measure them. I had very low insertion loss, and I had 18 or so pieces of those cable as my phasing harness on my 16 Yagi array. And in the beginning, it worked like a charm. When Hurricane Gloria brought that antenna down, I decided to make a measurement of those phasing harnesses made out of FM8 foam-filled RGH size cable. I found out that the insertion loss in decibels had either doubled or tripled because of the water vapor absorption through the jacket into the foam. And I said to myself when I made the first cable measurement of the 18 or 19 cables I had, I thought, well, maybe that cable is a Maverick. I measured all other 17 or 18 of them, and they all had roughly the same insertion loss. They had all sucked up the same amount of water into the foam through the polyvinyl chloride jacket. So this gives you some of the things to worry about. Now you know why in many commercial situations, the person not only makes sure that there's the right kind of rubber seals inside of all of the right places of the connector that's on the end of the cable, but when they install the cable outdoors onto an antenna, they wrap it with various kinds of tape, and sometimes they put a great big ball of stuff around each connector, which is a pain in the neck to cut through if you have to open that connector. But keeping water out of connectors is something you have to fight very hard for if you want low insertion loss. Certainly at VHF and UHF frequencies, and to some degree the problem also exists on HF frequencies. WS2N, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very, very good, Dick. Good explanation. Yeah, I was wondering, you know, well, between the cars, you know, I've changed wires over the years. So the wires are old and they absorb water. On the side, you take and throw them out, put a brand new set on. Fine, you know, that's amazing. When you get that kind of result. Same thing for my RGAU cable. I don't see any water in that, and I do have the, I don't have the foam for a dielectric, so that's good. Probably never have to change that. Oh, never is a bad word, but I mean that stuff has been up there for, I guess, almost 20 years now, and never had a problem with that. I have a problem with a balance, more of W1AU, one of those balance had cracked one time, and even though it's PVC, it was a little fine crack in there. Water had gotten in there, and had it on a 20-meter dipole at one time, and looking at the SWR, and this is this, I'm checking this, checking that. Finally, I got to the point where I decided to, it looked like a hairline crack. So, well, let me open this up. It's shot anyway, probably. Took it apart, and there's a coil in there. Sure enough, there was a whole bunch of water sitting inside this PVC type balance thing. So I've done away with that years ago, and just went with just a standard dipole with no no balance. I realize I should have one in there, but I don't. It works fine. But just wondering about this water problem situation. Back to you, and whenever you want a space report, we'll do that. Now that Atlantis is up there. This is WS2N.
W2T.
Very heavy modulation. I think it was W2T, but it was so distorted I couldn't tell. Back off from the mic and try again, sir. My name is Dick. Hello, we're waiting for you.
Node number 7820, link active.
Okay, there's one person ahead of you, Paul, and we're going to come back to the space report. And there was something else that you had just mentioned that I was going to comment on. Slipped my mind. Sorry to keep you waiting so long, Bob. N2MPJ, I think it is. Go right ahead with your question. K2RW in the second half.
I appreciate that, Dick. No sweat. Got two questions. The first one is, I just learned that in the United Kingdom, their power lines and their power line frequency is deliberately varied from